It's the 15th of January, 1958, Windsor Park. The final whistle is about to go. Northern Ireland are about to beat Italy 2-1 in a famous victory. Famous not simply because of who their opponents are, but because of what it means. Only a few short years before, Northern Ireland had been the whipping boys. Always dependable to lose. In the home internationals tournaments, losing was commonplace, sometimes by big margins. But in recent years, something had begun to click. Legendary player, now turned manager, Peter Doherty had overseen a dramatic turn of fortunes. With people like Harry Gregg, Alf McMichael, Wilbur Cush, Jimmy McElroy, Danny and Jackie Blanchflower, Billy Bingham, Billy Simpson and Peter McParland, they became formidable. With skill and guile, they had steered their country in a different direction. A direction that would take them to incredible, never-before-seen places and cement their legacy as legends in Northern Ireland football history. They felt like they could take on the world, and they were about to. Northern Ireland was on its way to Sweden and the 1958 World Cup. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with Caelan Kerwin and football historian Gary Spain. Coming up on this week's podcast, we're looking at how Northern Ireland qualified for the 1958 World Cup and how they fared at the tournament in Sweden. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops, plus some bonus clips as well. Now, let's get on with the show. So I suppose, Gary, the last time we left off talking about Northern Ireland football, I think it was fair to say that they were getting a bit of a kicking in nearly every single match they were playing. So I suppose in this, we're going to talk about probably one of the greatest moments in Northern Ireland football, which was them getting to the 1958 World Cup in Sweden. But it wasn't as plain sailing as that. I think the last time we left off, we were around about the 1940s for them. The spectre of World War II, of course, was there as well. That had an effect on the national team. But I suppose, why don't you kind of give us a brief timeline as to what happened up into the 1950s from that point?
Yeah, so the 1950s were probably a bit much of the same, really. Initially, it was the same story in the British Championship. The early 1950s, they didn't really make too much of an impact. The heavy defeats we talked about in the late 40s, I mean, you go into the 50s, you're talking about a 6-1 defeat by Scotland. The game against France, actually, in 1951, which was quite unusual, a bit novel visitors to Belfast, because normally it was just the British Championship, but they played France in the Festival of Britain. I think we've talked about the Festival of Britain before, but Northern Ireland playing France was part of that. I suppose if there's anything to say, the defeats by England were a bit smaller. There were closer games. You're seeing results like 2-0, 3-1, a 2-2 draw in Belfast. So signs that things were maybe a bit improving. The odd win over Wales. I mean, the first win in the 50s was against Wales in 1954. So a win over Scotland in 55, which maybe was a sign things were starting to improve. And as you go on into 56, a draw with England, signs that things were starting to get better. Finished 1956 with a narrow defeat against Scotland. But still, I think nothing to show what was to come. And I think if we start in 1957, it was a phenomenal period for Northern Ireland, and one that's rightly still talked about and celebrated as probably, we can go on and talk about Billy Bingham as a manager, but in Billy Bingham's time as a player, It's probably the greatest era. I know, I appreciate that might be controversial given that Billy got him to two World Cups and won two British Championships. But so maybe I think it's fair to say this, the achievement in 58 is probably their best ever tournament. And I suppose it starts in January 1957, but it starts with an incredibly difficult World Cup qualifying group. And the qualifying group, it was the first time actually that Northern Ireland were in a World Cup qualifying group separate to the home championship, because they didn't enter, none of the home nations entered the World Cup before World War II. For 1950, the home championship counted as qualification. There were actually two places on offer, but Scotland, as we discussed before, refused to go unless they won the home championship, and England won it, so England went alone to Brazil. In 1954, again, there were two places on offer, but for the home championship, but this time Scotland and England did go. But for the first time in 1958, the home nations were spread out in qualifying. And it's fair to say Northern Ireland got an incredibly difficult group. They were drawn against Portugal, let's say one of the top nations, maybe not so much at the time, but still one of the top nations in world football, and against Italy, who had already at that stage already won two World Cups, and Italy had never failed to qualify for a World Cup. And that's a record they held right up until 2018. They only failed once to qualify for a World Cup from the initial World Cup to 2018. And the one time they failed was in 1958, without giving the game away here. So
it is a huge turnaround, though, isn't it? I mean, like, you're talking in the space of, I suppose, 3 or 4 years, they go from being whipping boys to standing on the kind of the cusp of history with this team. And it's quite extraordinary. And I suppose a lot of the focus and a lot of the, I suppose, the reason for that has been put at this, I suppose, the footsteps of the manager who came in, which was Peter Doherty, who himself in his own right had become a legend in kind of Irish football and Northern Ireland football as well. So maybe if we kind of look at him as how he got this kind of this ball rolling towards this.
Yeah, so I mean, Peter Doherty, and I suppose as the years go on, there's probably no one left to describe and say they saw Peter Doherty play football. There's not that many now, because I mean, his best years were probably taken out by World War II.
Yeah.
But a lot of his great achievements were before the war, but he still, his career bookended World War II. He was playing in the 30s, started off with Coleraine, went to Glentoran, won the Irish Cup with Glentoran, moved across the water, moved to Blackpool, I think, initially, and then ended up being transferred to Manchester City for the astronomical fee of £10,000, as it was at the time, which was almost a British record. Mm. And it's fair to say he was a phenomenal player. He was an inside forward. I suppose a modern day midfield player, a modern day Kevin De Bruyne. And I mean, arguably, not even arguably, one of the greatest players of all time. I mean, he was inducted into the FA Hall of Fame. They initially inducted 22 players when they set it up. That's almost a quarter of a century ago now, and he was one of the 22. Was part of Man City's, a key part, I think he scored 30 goals from inside forward, a key part of Man City winning their first ever top-flight title. They won the league in 1936-37, and Peter Doherty was one of the key players in that side.
Yeah, he was top goal scorer. I think he was top goal scorer with 33.
Yeah, he scored 30 goals. I think it was 30, but he certainly scored a lot of goals from inside forward. And he was just a complete player. He could do everything. He could run, he could tackle, he could pass, he could shoot, and he could score. Went and served in World War II, came back and was transferred to Derby County and won the FA Cup with Derby in 1946. And continued playing. His last cap for Northern Ireland was, I think, in 1950, and then took over as manager. And not only was he a legendary player. There's actually, he was born in Maharafelt, and there's a plaque. If you actually go to Maharafelt, which is the hometown, of course, of Myola Park, who won the, sorry, it's not Myola Park, they're in Castle Dawson nearby, but it's very near. The Maharafelt is quite close to the original
Gary,
winners. At the, yeah, I'm getting myself mixed up here. But Maharafelt, anyway, there's a plaque, you know, the blue plaque on the house where he was born in Maharafelt. So he took over as manager in the early 1950s. And he also was a bit of a revolutionary as a manager as well, because he had a long career in English football as a manager as well. He managed Doncaster Rovers, managed a number of clubs. But as Northern Ireland manager, he actually changed things a lot in the 50s. There was a big focus on the time. Basically, training consisted of players running laps of the pitch and just building up their fitness. And he changed things completely. And he did a lot more ball work. And there was a theory at the time, which sounds a bit ridiculous now. You keep the ball away from the players during the week, so they'll be really hungry for it on a Saturday afternoon. But and Peter saw, yeah, okay.
That's why Roy Keane left Saipan. But yeah, he sounds like a really kind of a guy who's really about football and understanding football, and that football isn't just this kind of thing that everybody else should do, that if you're going to put your stamp on it, you think about it differently, and you encourage your players to, I suppose, think on the pitch as well.
Yeah, he did. And I mean, he adopted all sorts of unusual methods in training. He had the players playing volleyball. He had them certainly using the ball a lot in training. And I mean, he was a ball player himself. And now it did help that he had some real quality players, legendary players. But I think having Peter Doherty as manager was a key part in that Northern Ireland side being so successful, because, as I said, it was incredibly difficult. They were certainly quite unlucky with the draw to qualify for the World Cup.
One of the things that I read when obviously doing research for this, but one of the things that his influence as a manager was that players who had grown up on this kind of the stories of this myth, this legend of Peter Doherty, were now, you know, his students of the game. They were learning from him, and they revered him so much as a player that now they were getting managed by this, their hero, so to speak. And I know part of what I read anyway was Billy Bingham basically saying, look, all of a sudden this was this hero that we all revered, and he was managing us, and we wanted to do our absolute best for this legend that we all grew up on.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, because he was probably the original, one of the original superstars to come out of Northern Ireland. You know, I mean, obviously we want to talk about George Best after that, but Peter Doherty was an absolute legend. He was revered. That comment from Billy makes perfect sense.
To qualification then, where we kind of started there, we drifted off into the legend that is Peter Doherty. But it's fair to say that, you mentioned it already, but it's a really tough draw. You've got a Portugal side that's, I suppose, not quite at the legendary status that was to come in the next couple of years, but they were on the cusp, really. And of course, Italy had been a kind of a powerhouse in world football for a long time as well. So it was kind of stacked against them from the start, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they would have been certainly third favourites at that stage to qualify. I think everybody would have expected this very talented Italian side to qualify quite comfortably, but that wasn't the way it panned out. And there's even a great story and a long story in the whole qualification that transcends even football, but I suppose we can just get into it.
yeah absolutely, yeah, we're always up for the good stories. But it starts off in January 1957, and they start away at Portugal.
Yeah, so it was a difficult, I mean, the fixtures were agreed in those days, and I don't think Northern Ireland got the rub of the green in the fixtures, certainly, because they had to start away in Lisbon in the Sporting Jose Abeladze Stadium and then go to Rome. So they started in Lisbon, but they started incredibly well. The Billy Bingham we were talking about, that talented winger, as opposed to the really talented manager, Billy Bingham opened in the first 5-6 minutes, he put Northern Ireland ahead. But Portugal equalised midway through the first half. And it was one of those games. The legendary Harry Gregg, who obviously have to go on and talk about, was actually blamed for the goal, but he made a fantastic save afterwards. And both teams could have won it in the second half, but they had to settle for a 1-1 draw. Now, certainly a 1-1 draw in Lisbon is an exceptionally good result, but it was probably a result that suited Italy. That was the very first game for Northern Ireland, but also the first game of the campaign in January 57. It was also described as being played in freezing cold weather, but I suppose it was January.
So. January in Portugal, their freezing cold weather is what, 20 degrees? but it's a great start. But then they have to go to Italy then and play Italy away as part of those two really tough fixtures to start the group as well. And a huge attendance, as you might expect as well, for Italy to take on Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I've seen the attendance from anything from 70 to 90,000, depending on what you read. But certainly it was a huge attendance. A huge game. Italy's opening qualifier. Italy scored early. They went 1-0 up. But at the end, they were actually hanging on. And it's actually recorded that Northern Ireland hit the woodwork 3 times in the last 10 minutes. But somehow they couldn't force the equaliser, and Italy started their campaign with a 1-0 win, a very fortunate 1-0 win, but enough to put them very much in the driving seat for the group.
I would imagine as well, as they've gone away to Portugal, they've drawn 1-1, they've been very unlucky not to come away with a draw in Italy as well. So I suppose from their point of view, it's not necessarily doom and gloom. They're putting in the performances and maybe not quite getting the results that they would have hoped, but it's still a good start, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would have to be considered a good start. There's no question about that. I suppose losing the game when there's only 1 to qualify does make it very difficult. Particularly with Portugal, I suppose the advantage was they had Portugal coming to Belfast a week later and with a chance to make amends and keep in contention.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's that match against Portugal that really kind of puts the cat amongst the pigeons enough, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, that was an incredible performance, an incredible result. And a week after losing in Rome, Northern Ireland absolutely thrashed. They thrashed Portugal. I think it's the only way to describe it. They beat them 3-0. It was the first time in over 20 years that Northern Ireland had scored 3 goals in an international. Tom Casey, Newcastle United, put them ahead. The legendary Billy Simpson got the second goal on the hour mark. And the legendary Jimmy McElroy, there's so many legends in that Northern Ireland squad of that era. Jimmy McElroy, the Burnley legend, scored from the penalty spot with 20 minutes to go. And it was a 3-0 thrashing. Suddenly, I mean, there were 3 games played in the group at this stage. Northern Ireland had played in all 3. And suddenly they were top of the group. Okay, they were only a point ahead of Italy, who had 2 games in hand. But suddenly qualification was back on the agenda. And it was to be a long wait for Northern Ireland's next game. That result certainly laid down a marker.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's nearly 6 months or so, 6 or 7 months till their next game. But in the swings and the roundabouts that we've kind of talked about before, where the nations kind of set out their own schedule in terms of how they play, it kind of turns against both Italy and Portugal because they take points off each other.
Yeah, so a few weeks after their thrashing in Belfast, Portugal entertained Italy and in front of 37,000 fans, thrashed Italy by 3-0, which was quite a turnaround and certainly a result that definitely favoured Northern Ireland. But that, of course, put Portugal back in the mix for qualification as well. And that was all to set up the next game in the group. Well, what was meant to be the next game in the group in early December 1957, was when Northern Ireland entertained Italy with a chance to ensure qualification. But of course, there were a couple of very important games to come for Northern Ireland before that. And that was in the British Championship, the 1957-58 British Championship, which Northern Ireland hadn't won. Or, well, they won it as Ireland in 1914, but hadn't won it since. But in October 1957, they went to, they played Scotland in Belfast, drew 1-1, and a month later went to Wembley to play England and had a first win over England for, I think it was 30 years at that stage, and a very famous 3-2 win at Wembley with Billy Simpson claiming the an assist and then claiming the winner. But Harry Gregg was actually the hero with some incredible saves, particularly at the death as England came from 3-1 down to 3-2 and were banging down the door for the winner, sorry, for the equaliser. So that put Northern Ireland in great shape to actually win the home championship in 57-58. But all eyes suddenly turned in December 1957 to the crucial qualifier against Italy, when a win for Northern Ireland would more well have them with one foot in the finals, and at least would require Portugal needing to go to Milan and beat Italy to deny them. So game was all set for December 1957. A record crowd was expected in Windsor Park. People had taken a half day off work. It was midweek. But one of the issues they had was the referee was coming from Budapest, and he was fogged. There was bad fog in London, and his plane the day before the game was delayed. The IFA took precautions on this, and they arranged for the legendary Arthur Ellis. I think Arthur Ellis, he was a legendary FIFA referee, and he'd refereed the 1954 World Cup final, if I remember correctly. Arthur Ellis arrived by boat to Belfast as a backup, just in case the referee was going to be fogbound again on match day, which indeed he was, and he never got to Belfast. So then with the already thousands of people through the turnstiles, there came a war of words between the IFA and the Italian Football Federation, because the Italians weren't accepting Arthur Ellis as being a neutral referee, and it got the mayor of Belfast involved. And in the end, they couldn't come to an agreement, and the game, they couldn't agree to play the World Cup qualifier. So this faced the IFA with an incredible dilemma, because they'd sold tens of thousands of tickets. People had taken a half day off work, which was no mean thing in those days. It was costing these people a lot of money. And a lot of them were already in the ground, and trying to tell them they weren't going to see a big World Cup qualifier. The Italians agreed to play a friendly match with Arthur Ellis as referee. That still didn't keep the crowd happy. As you can imagine, they had bought tickets for a World Cup qualifier. They were going to see a friendly. There was a lot of boos. There was a lot of stuff thrown. The game got known as the Battle of Belfast. The crowd were angry at the Italians. They were angry at the IFA. They were angry at everybody. The game itself actually was a bit of a cracker. It ended in a 2-2 draw. Wilbur Cush, the legendary Glenavon player, scored a couple of goals. He was already at Leeds at that stage, but he equalised twice for Northern Ireland. And ironically, the 2-2 draw would have sent Italy to the World Cup if they could have beaten Portugal. But it was a friendly. They even before the match, there was an agreement signed between the two federations and the mayor of Belfast to say it was a friendly. So there was absolutely no doubt about it. And it finished in a 2-2 draw, but they had to agree to come back. Italy had to agree to come back to Belfast in January 58.
Wow. Ellis, where does Ellis come in from? Is it Scotland? If he's coming in by boat?
Well, he came from Stranraer, but he obviously got the train off from England. I'm trying to remember what part of England. I can't remember what part of England. He's obviously somewhere in Northern England, and they were able to get him on a train to Stranraer and come across in the boat.
But essentially, the Italians' argument was, well, hold on a second, he's from a home nation's country, so we don't feel that they're necessarily going to judge us in the same fashion, so we're not doing this football match.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably fair enough. But having said that, I mean, at the time, Arthur Ellis was probably the Pier Luigi Collina of his day. I mean, he would have been one of the most famous referees of all time, really. You know, it's he would have been very well respected. It shows how much they feared and respected Northern Ireland as well.
Yeah.
That they didn't want to take any chances at all. But it's hard to believe that somebody like Arthur Ellis would have favoured a fellow home nation.
Is there an ironic twist in that it comes back to bite the Italians later on as well? I mean, we'll see it happen later, but they have to play Portugal first then before they play the other qualifier then in January. So the fixtures kind of leap over each other and they're back to a qualifier against Portugal then.
Yeah, so they played, as you said, they played Portugal 3 days before Christmas in December 1957. And they beat them, they hammered them 3-0 in Milan. So that was Portugal out of the World Cup. And that made the group basically very, very simple. So Italy were sitting on 4 points. There was 2 points for a win in those days, of course. Italy were sitting on 4 points. Northern Ireland were sitting on 3 points. And Portugal, having played all their games, were finished on 3 points. So it was very simple. A win or a draw for Italy in Belfast, and they were going to Sweden, and Northern Ireland had to win. It was very simple. And it set up from what looked like a decider in December, early December 57. On the 15th of January 1958, it was absolutely a decider to see who would go to the World Cup.
Yeah, and it's a huge game. And again, the attendance is huge at Windsor Park. It's a massive game. How did it go?
So it was a massive game. People again had to take a half day off work. It was again played midweek. There was 50,000 packed into Windsor Park. And I mean, that's the really old Windsor Park.
Yeah.
That was the one, the Gallagher stand and the old South stand, which I'm sure some people, I mean, it hasn't changed that reason. Changed maybe what, 10 years ago. It was there up until maybe a bit longer. So I'm sure many people know it. The old reserve terrace in front, and otherwise it was all terrace. I mean, that north stand wasn't built until when the 1980s. So it was the Windsor Park that many people would have known, certainly up until right up to the 70s. It was mainly terraces. I don't know how they got 50,000 in there, but they did. Certainly no health and safety in those days.
Those old broken gates at the start.
Oh, there's been many stories about many games and the old broken gates. And in many cases, those estimates, an estimate in reality. It certainly started very well for Northern Ireland. Jimmy McIlroy put them ahead in 13 minutes. Wilbur Cush made it 2-0 just before the half hour, but there was still a long way to go, and Italy gradually got control of the game. And the contemporary newspaper reports described their passing in midfield as starting to take control. Da Costa pulled one back 11 minutes into the second half, and they were pushing strongly for an equaliser. And a rather strange event happened with 20 minutes to go, which possibly had an influence in the game, in that their legendary striker, Gigia, who was actually originally Argentinian, he got sent off with 20 minutes to go. Now, he got sent off for a late challenge on Alf McMichael, the legendary Newcastle United fullback. But what's actually strange about the incident was McMichael says he didn't remember too much. He cleared the ball and suddenly ended up on his backside. But he actually remonstrated with the referee and tried to allow Gigia to be left on the pitch because he felt it wasn't a foul or it wasn't a red card. And despite the full back on the opposition side, very, very sportingly, obviously, you certainly wouldn't see that happening today.
There'll be lads surrounding the referee now.
Well, it's despite Alf McMichael's protests and Gigia was sent off, and it kind of, with 10 men, kind of ended Italy and Northern Ireland held on for a very, very famous win, and a 2-1 win that sent them to the World Cup in Sweden.
So the irony of complaining about the referee the last time when they actually got the result they wanted, it turned out that it cost them the match than the actual qualifier.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, I mean, obviously there isn't any footage of it that I'm aware of. There's actually loads of footage of the 2-2 draw, but there isn't any footage of the red card incident that I'm aware of. So it's hard to say, but given Alf McMichael was pleading his case, it's probably fair to say the referee may have made a mistake. And a referee as experienced and legendary as Arthur Ellis would have probably been unlikely, but of course he was never assigned to that game. So who knows?
Yeah, and it's extraordinary because we kind of talked about it before. Back then, it would have taken quite a bit to get sent off, would it not? I mean, like, it would have to been a horrendous tackle.
It would, yes. I think that's fair to say. Right up even into the 70s when I first started watching football, it took a lot more to get sent off. The red cards would be a lot less frequent than they are today, let's say. So back in the 1950s, that would have been unusual. There weren't too many red cards in those days. And it does sound like even the Belfast, the newsletter reports, etc., was kind of a little bit mystified. So you would have to say they would be favouring Northern Ireland. So I think it's probably fair to say very, very sporting of Alf McMichael, but it sounds like one the referee may have got wrong.
But it doesn't matter because Northern Ireland were on their way to a World Cup extraordinarily. They start off the group as probably expecting to be very much firmly at the bottom of the group, but now they're heading to the World Cup. Do we have any idea of what the joy or the ecstasy around this? Was this a massive occasion for Northern Ireland football? Did people buy into it? Did they really understand what was happening?
Well, I think they did. I mean, the World Cup, I think it's fair to say the World Cup in 1958 wasn't as big as it is now, but certainly it was a huge occasion and huge celebrations. And I mean, the fact that 50,000 on a midweek afternoon in January packed into Windsor Park showed how important the game was and how much it meant to Northern Ireland to actually qualify. And another point to make at that stage was that England had already qualified. I won't say who they knocked out, but Scotland had already qualified, and Wales, which is another famous story, were on the cusp of qualification themselves. So it actually became the first time and so far the only time that all four home nations qualified for the World Cup.
Extraordinary. Fantastic stuff. So they're all heading to the big dance, as they say. Do we know kind of what the preparation is for how are they preparing to I suppose go to this major international tournament?
Well, I mean, the only game between the Italy game and the World Cup was actually the final British Championship game against Wales, which ended in a draw, and actually it meant Northern Ireland shared the title with England. But had they beaten Wales, they would have won it outright for the first time since 1914. So that maybe was a little bit of a disappointment. All it has to be said, Wales were coming off their own World Cup qualification. So there weren't any warm-up matches as such. If the draw in qualification was unkind, the draw for the finals was even more unkind, with an incredibly tough group. You had the reigning world champions, West Germany. You had the reigning South American champions in Argentina. And you had a crack Czechoslovakian side who had been, well, they'd been runners up in 34. They were to go on to be runners up in 1962 as well, a really talented side at the time. So a really tough group for Northern Ireland. Probably should just mention a couple of things that happened between January 58 and the finals in Sweden. Because and one of the key things that happened was the Munich air disaster in February 1958. And Manchester United, I'm sure many people already know the story. Manchester United had played a European Cup tie in Belgrade. The plane had stopped in Munich to refuel. And in driving snow, the plane failed to clear the runway and crashed in Munich. And unfortunately, 23 people were killed, including 8 Manchester United players. But I do want to go on and talk about, because we talk about heroes and there are so many legendary heroes in that Northern Ireland side. I talked about Alf McMichael. You have the likes of Denny Blanchflower, Dick Keith, Billy Bingham, Billy Simpson, Peter McParran. Go on and talk about a number of them. But it all pales into insignificance when you talk about Harry Gregg. Now, Harry Gregg was a legendary goalkeeper and a fantastic goalkeeper. But he survived the Munich disaster and he got out of the plane. But he crawled back into a burning plane and rescued a young pregnant mother and her daughter. And I suppose when you talk about heroes, everything else doesn't really matter when you talk about someone like that.
Yeah, I remember seeing a documentary where he went back to Munich and the airport and stuff like that, and you could tell it was something that never really left him. Perhaps he didn't talk about it as that much, or you could tell that it's something that he carried with him for a very long time up until obviously when he died. But I think that word hero, when we use it in football terms, we often use it to describe, you know, a person's skill or perhaps a moment that they gave, you know, a team, etc. But very much in the sense of the word as a hero, I mean, to be in that situation and then to have the awareness to go back into that situation, that dangerous situation, and try and save people, try and help people, was an extraordinary act of courage that was just completely selfless.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. And I mean, it's just hard to put into words, to be honest. There is a video on YouTube which I would encourage people to watch. When Harry was at Swansea, assistant manager at Swansea, he actually he was the BBC on the 25th anniversary, flew in Mrs. Lukic and her now adult daughter. Her son was born a few months later and a healthy child, and they flew them to meet Harry, and he was just a big humble man, but he was it's just incredible to think that he saved three lives that day. It was a horrendous tragedy and so many. Our own Liam Whelan was among the eight players who lost their lives that day. And others, Danny Blanchard's brother Jackie, his career was ended that day as well. But for Harry to actually crawl into that plane and rescue those people was just, I just can't describe it in words.
And meeting her again and then seeing their kids, it's an extraordinary example of that kind of, I suppose, that ripple effect that can happen in life. One stranger's extraordinary act of courage has a ripple effect for a whole family who get to live and grow up when so many of his teammates around him didn't get that chance either, because some of them were quite young too as well. So there's that amazing kind of ripple effect that happens with somebody just doing that selfless piece of courage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I can only imagine the effect everything had on him and it had on everyone that survived on that incredibly sad day.
Absolutely, yeah. So where does that leave, I suppose, the preparation and Northern Ireland then going for Sweden in 58? It's something that is huge and I suppose casts a specter on the team as well. So how do they kind of go through this and move forward with this themselves as a team?
I suppose it's hard to say. I mean, it obviously impacted on a number of teams. It impacted on the England team losing Duncan Edwards, who was arguably their greatest player. It's hard to say what impact it had on Harry Gregg at the time. Obviously Jackie Blanchflower survived the crash, but he was injured. He wasn't able to play in Sweden. Another footnote to actually mention was Wales. The Man United's assistant manager, Jimmy Murphy, was not on the plane because Wales were given a second chance to qualify for the 58 World Cup So Israel had been in the African Asian qualification group, and the Arab League at the time decided to boycott games against Israel. So Israel were drawn to play Sudan to see who qualified for the World Cup. When Sudan withdrew, the FIFA decided you can't have a country going to the World Cup without winning at least one match or without beating somebody. So they decided that the runners up in the European groups would all be put into a hat, and a team would be drawn out to play Israel to decide who goes to the World Cup. And there's actually different stories to this. I've seen it written down that Belgium actually decided they didn't want to be in the hat, because if they, a bit like Scotland in 1950, saying we're not going to the World Cup unless we were going as British champions and winners. So Belgium decided, well, we didn't qualify, we didn't win our group, so we're not going through any back door. We don't want to be in the hat. I've seen another report that Belgium were actually the first out of the hat and then declined the invitation. So I think that needs to maybe be clarified, but it's certainly a fact that Belgium declined the chance to go to the World Cup because they weren't group winners. So Wales ended up being the lucky losers, and they beat Israel home and away. And the reason Jimmy Murphy wasn't on the plane to Munich, sorry, on the plane from Munich, was because he was also assistant manager of Man United, but manager of Wales, and he was needed for the return leg in Cardiff against Israel. And when Wales actually qualified for 1958, in February 58, they became the fourth home nation to qualify.
Wow, extraordinary. And he would go on to take Manchester United through that dark period after the Munich air disaster as well, while Bosabir was recovering. So an extraordinary kind of turn of fates there for this team. So as you mentioned before, the group draw is extraordinarily tough on Northern Ireland. If the qualification was tough, the group stage for the World Cup was tough. There's four in the group. Was that normal at the time?
Yeah. So at the time, the World Cup was a 16-team tournament. So it was four groups of four, the top two going through to the quarterfinals and straight knockout from there on. West Germany, world champions in 1954, the miracle of Bern. They still had their legendary captain, Fritz Walter. They still had Rot-Weiss Essen's Helmut Rahn up front, legendary striker. And at least one other whose name escapes me from that famous side. But look, there's never a bad German side. Yeah. You had Argentina, the Kingpins had won the South American Championship, the best team in South America, although they had the title going to Sweden, I think they may have lost it by the end. And you had a very, very talented Czechoslovakian side who said had been runners-up in 1934, and to Italy, of course, and were to go on and be runners-up in 1962 as well. So it's a very tough group. Northern Ireland was certainly fourth favourites.
And their first match in the championship is against Czechoslovakia. I wanted to ask you as well, is this a Czechoslovakian team perhaps in a little bit of transition? Because they were kind of, they were incredibly good and very, very big on in world football through the 30s, etc. Are they that kind of powerhouse now when Northern Ireland meets them?
I think it's fair to say they were still
good,
a formidable force. They had qualified in 54, if I remember correctly. And I suppose they were building towards the team in 62. They actually had quite a decent tournament, if we go on to talk about. Yeah. They obviously they lost first up to Northern Ireland, but they came very close to making the knockouts, and who knows what might have happened after that. But certainly they would have been favourites in the Swedish town of Halmstad. 8th of June 1958, Northern Ireland made their World Cup debut. In a tight game, Wilbur Cush, then of Leeds United, got the only goal in 21 minutes, and certainly was a very famous win for Northern Ireland in their first ever World Cup game.
Yeah, and it's huge. And I suppose as well, if we kind of put it on our side of the border, if you want to put it that way, when we went to Euro 88, beating England 1-0, etc., it's massive. It changes the whole parameter of what you're doing and what you're capable of doing in the tournament, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what a way to start. I mean, you're probably written off, probably not given much of a chance, and to go out and beat a major footballing power in your first World Cup match really lays down a marker. And I suppose at the same time, further south in Malmo, West Germany, the reigning world champions, were coming from behind to beat Argentina 3-1 with a couple of goals from Helmut Rahn, as I mentioned, that legendary striker. And they had a young fella by the name Uwe Seeler as well, making his World Cup debut, and he capped that with the goal that put Germany ahead. Mm-hmm. And of course, he went on to be a legendary German striker as well.
Turned out to be quite good, that young lad, Uwe Seeler, over time.
Absolutely.
So they've won their first game, an extraordinary result. They win 1-0. Fantastic. I suppose it's the ecstasy to the agony then for the match against Argentina, and I suppose brought back down to earth just a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, it started so well, having beaten Czechoslovakia, Northern Ireland, stayed in Halmstad, and went out again against Argentina, as I said, the South American champions. And Peter McParland of Aston Villa, the Newry man, put them ahead after 4 minutes, scoring his first, certainly not his last, World Cup goal to put Northern Ireland ahead. Just before half-time, Argentina equalised from a controversial penalty that was hotly disputed. But in the second half, they scored a couple of quick goals in the first 15 minutes to run out 3-1 winners. And as you say, it certainly brought Northern Ireland back down to earth, and left them on 2 points in a difficult situation in the group.
Yeah, it's a tough one to take when you're on a high of winning your first game, massive game as well. But the game against Germany then must be a real confidence taker for Northern Ireland. It's a brilliant German side, and they managed to get something out of the game.
Yeah, so I suppose I should mention at the same time that in those days in the World Cup, there was, I'm pretty sure that they certainly weren't covered live on television. All the games were on, played at the same time. So West Germany were playing Czechoslovakia at the same time, and Argentina were playing Northern Ireland. And ironically, in Helsingborg, the referee for the West Germany Czechoslovakia, you'll never guess, Mr. Arthur Ellis of England. So, and that was, I mean, the Czechs certainly redeemed themselves. They were 2-0 up in the first half in that game, but Germany came roaring back to earn a 2-2 draw and put them in control of the group. Our old friend Helmut Rahn got the equaliser, so they left themselves on 3 points with a win and a draw on top of the group. It left Argentina and Northern Ireland on 2 points, and Czechoslovakia at the bottom on one. It was all down to the final day then, when again the games obviously kicked off 4 days later, the 15th of June. West Germany and Northern Ireland in Malmo, and Czechoslovakia were facing Argentina in Helsingborg. And the Germans needed a draw to make sure of progress. Argentina and Northern Ireland needed a win to be sure of qualifying. And the Czechs needed a win, and probably needed favours as well. From a Northern Ireland point of view, it was another incredible game up against world champions. Mm. They led twice. Peter McParland, the man who put them ahead against Argentina, put them ahead again against Germany. Our own friend Helmut Rahn quickly equalised. That was in the 20th minute. Peter McParland had scored in the 18th minute. Into the second half, Northern Ireland were playing really, really well. Peter McParland put them back ahead on the hour mark. But up popped this young fella, Uwe Seeler, who went on to have such an impact across four World Cups. But he equalised with 12 minutes to go to send Germany into the quarterfinals. And it's not clear how Northern Ireland even found out these things in these days, because telecommunications were not what they were now. But they were obviously waiting on the result from Helsingborg to find out, because if Argentina had beaten the Czechs, they were joining the Germans in the quarterfinals. If it was a draw, there was no goal difference involved. Northern Ireland would have a playoff with Argentina. And if the Czechs won, Northern Ireland would have a playoff with the Czechs. Now, it transpired, we're talking about the Czechs, a coming team. They hammered Argentina by 6-1. Quite an impressive result. And that obviously set up a playoff between Czechoslovakia and Northern Ireland 2 days later for a quarterfinal place. Now, I think it was a bit unfair and a bit unfortunate on teams in those days that already played 3 group games. The quarterfinals were going to be 4 days later. So having played West Germany, having played 3 games in a week against top teams, Northern Ireland were already facing a quarterfinal if they got through 4 days later, but instead had to play a playoff 2 days later. And if they won, then had to go into a quarterfinal. And as it turned out, actually, 3 of the 4 home nations ended up in the playoff situation. So Northern Ireland ended up in a playoff with Czechoslovakia and Malmo on the 17th of June.
What's the criteria in the situation with Northern Ireland? What's the criteria for the playoff? Is it just you have an equal amount of points and that's it, you go for a playoff? Or was there no...
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no goal difference, no goal average, which goal average was actually quite common in those days. But no, it was, if you finish level on points, then you have a playoff. And as I said, having to play on the 15th of June, then play on the 17th of June, and if they win, play on the 19th of June, was incredibly unfair. Wales... having got the reprieve and already won a playoff to reach the World Cup, they ended up in a playoff with England. Wales ended up in a playoff with Hungary, and England ended up in a playoff with the Soviet Union. And, we won't talk about Scotland doing their World Cup trick, but the Wales incredibly beat Hungary again. I mean, Hungary had been the runners-up in 1954, so it was an incredible achievement by the Welsh to beat them in the playoff and go on to face a certain nation by the name of Brazil in the quarterfinals in Gothenburg. England were beaten by the Soviet Union, so they went home early. And but Northern Ireland in Malmo faced a Czechoslovakia team that was surely on a high, having thrashed the South American champions 6-1 place in the quarterfinals.
Yeah, you mentioned that kind of goal average was kind of usually the separator as a norm kind of around about then. But I mean, if it had been considered, surely Czechoslovakia might have gone through, because they hammered Argentina by 6.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to put my math skills to the test now, because it certainly, a goal average did favour teams who conceded fewer goals, but without trying to divide the goals conceded
into the average.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that Northern Ireland would have scored 4 goals and conceded 5. Yeah. The Czechs would have scored 8 and conceded 4. So, yes, definitely. I mean, the Czechs' goal average would have been 2 because it's 8 divided by 4. My maths isn't that bad. but 4 divided by 5 is point. Yeah, point so eight, I think yeah. It's fair to say that the Czechs would have had a better goal average. But it wasn't in play at the time in Northern Ireland. In fairness, the teams would have known that as well, yeah. So wouldn't necessarily have been chasing goals. So it was down to a playoff, but certainly it was unfair on the teams in the playoff that they were expected to. And Northern Ireland at this stage were already ravaged by injuries. In fact, Harry Gregg was out of the playoff. There were a couple of Billy Simpson, the legendary Billy Simpson, actually, he went to the World Cup but never kicked a ball. And he would have been considered a huge loss at the time. And there's a story there that the head trainer, Jerry Morgan, at one stage passed him fit to play. And the team doctor said he wasn't fit. And you have to say that at the stage where Northern Ireland were playing Czechoslovakia with the walking wounded and what went on, they really, even at three quarters fit, Billy Simpson may have made more of an impact. Mm. But anyway, that's a long time ago and so much water under the bridge.
I know I'm asking you this off the top of my head, but what was the squad criteria in terms of how many could you bring? And then, like, so in other words, nowadays we obviously have basically a backup for almost every position on the pitch. That's the size of the squad that you're kind of bringing. So, like, what was the kind of the squad criteria for around then? Was it you only brought maybe 15 players and that was that?
Well, that's actually, it's a very good question. And it's another one that
I'm putting you on the spot.
I know the facts in this case. And it's one that would probably cause a lot of regret for Northern Ireland, because the squad situation as it was at the time was you could bring 22 players. Oh. So each of the 16 countries could have brought 22 players. But Northern Ireland, for whatever reason, and I'm not sure if it was financial or whatever else, I mean, they had an initial squad of something like 40 players. There is a 22-player squad, which included the likes of Roy Ray, Len Graham of Doncaster Rovers, Sam Chapman of Portsmouth, the famous Tommy Hamill of Linfield, and they decided to only bring 17. Huh. So five of those players who were originally named in the squad did not get to go. So they brought two goalkeepers, Harry Gregg and Norman Pritchard, and brought 15 outfield players. And certainly you have to wonder, with the walking wounded that played Czechoslovakia and then went on to have to play in a quarterfinal 2 days later, mm-hmm. if they had brought the 22, which most other nations, I'm not aware of any other nations, but I'm not quite sure, that declined to bring the full complement of 22. But Northern Ireland decided to leave five players at home. And there were even a number of players, I can't remember off the top of my head now, but in the 40 that would have been reasonably well-known and top players at the time. Mm. So it was a strange decision. Mm. But you have to suspect it was probably financial.
Yeah, I was going to say that, because we kind of talked about it from a Republic of Ireland point of view as well, that, you know, sometimes there just wasn't enough money to bring everybody that you wanted. And it was a simple case of that, because, you know, whether you're getting on a boat or you're getting on a flight, it's going to be expensive to bring that amount of players, as well as, I suppose, some coaching staff, doctors, etc., all the way to Sweden as well from Northern Ireland. So maybe there's some clarification out somewhere, but I would say you're probably right. It was most likely a financial decision by the sounds of it. But nonetheless, they did play extraordinarily well against Czechoslovakia side that was on a high after giving Argentina a bit of a thrashing.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe one point to make on the financials as I go on to talk about the Czechoslovakia game is, we talked about the massive crowds that were at the qualifiers. A lot of the games in the finals, the World Cup, I'm sure Sweden were playing to huge crowds, but some of the attendances were quite small for a lot of these games. And I'm talking, there was only just over 21,000 at the Germany-Northern Ireland game, 10,000 at the initial game against the Czechs. There were only 6,000 people in Malmo at the playoff against Czechoslovakia. Mm. So I suppose the profits from that World Cup may not have been... Certainly the World Cup is not as lucrative, or anything close to as lucrative as it is today. Mm. I mean, if the IFA were to qualify for the World Cup next year in the United States, Mexico and Canada, it would set them up financially for many years to come. They would make certainly tens of millions of dollars. And back in 1958, it was a very different story. And it was still a massive tournament, but a lot of the games were played out to fairly empty stadiums. Mm. But getting on to talk about the game, and it has to go down as one of the greatest ever wins for Northern Ireland. They were facing a crack Czechoslovakian side just off the 6-1 thrashing of the South American champions, Argentina. They went to goal ahead after 18 minutes. And just before halftime, that man, Peter McParland, scoring his fourth goal in a World Cup. What an incredible achievement it was to get four goals. I will go on. Brought Northern Ireland level. And despite having played 2 days earlier, the game finished 1-1 after 90 minutes, and it was into extra time. So it was another more football 2 days after playing it. And that man, Peter McParland, again, scored his fifth World Cup goal and to become, a legendary legend. Northern Ireland hero, as well as a legend, an Aston Villa legend. He got the winner in extra time to pull off a famous win for Northern Ireland and set up a quarter final against France.
Because we talk about him, obviously, from a Republic of Ireland point of view. There's matches you can pinpoint and go, that match right there, you know, that's the big one. That's, you know, the great victory, etc. So this, I suppose this cannot be understated how massive this kind of victory is. It's their first tournament. They're in a World Cup. They're playing, you know, arguably one of the greatest teams in the tournament. They're very, very good, very talented Czechoslovakia side. And they go into extra time and they still... Yeah, with, as you mentioned before, with an injury kind of ravaged side, they still managed to pull off an extraordinary, fantastic victory.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think you've nailed it. I mean, for what they'd gone through, it was certainly the walking wounded. Harry Gregg became, well, the hero of Munich, but he was the goalkeeper of the tournament as well. He was named goalkeeper of the tournament in 1958.
Wow.
He was missing. Now, Norman O'Pritchard was a very decent deputy. But it was the walking wounded that took on Czechoslovakia. And it was an incredible achievement. And I have to say, one of Northern Ireland's greatest ever wins. I can't say they're greatest because I'm sure a lot of people are going to scream about a night in Valencia.
Yeah, exactly.
But it has to be up there with one of the greatest wins of all time for Northern Ireland to actually beat a side as talented as that Czechoslovakian side. And unfortunately, only in front of 6,000 people, but to beat them in extra time and go on to play in the last eight in quarterfinals of the World Cup. And it remains the only time, and I know Northern Ireland in 82 went on to the second phase, but it was actually technically the last 12. So it remains the only time Northern Ireland have actually played in the quarterfinals or the last eight of a major tournament.
Mm. Yeah, it's a incredible victory, and having to dig so deep as well into... in extra time as well to get that winner as well. And as you say, McParland makes himself the hero. So on then to the quarterfinal with France, I suppose, given what we've talked about and not altogether a surprise result, although obviously Northern Ireland wouldn't have wanted it that way.
There was also a sense of travel involved in this point as well. They had played their games between Halmstad and Malmö. If you know your Swedish geography, Malmö is right down in the southwest of Sweden, just over the bridge from Copenhagen. Halmstad is about halfway up the coast as you go up to Gothenburg. So then they had to travel right up through Sweden, up to Norrköping, which is right up in north in the middle. So it was quite a journey as well. 2 days after playing in Malmö against the Czechs, having gone to extra time, I think it's no surprise, actually, the three teams that came through the playoffs were all beaten 2 days later in the quarterfinals. There were only 11,800 there to watch it. It was obviously a very talented French side, a man by the name of Just Fontaine, who ended up with 13 goals in that tournament. He grabbed a couple of goals. It was quite close. Northern Ireland held out until the 44th minute. But it was definitely a case of a bridge too far, and France scored three more in the second half to run out 4-0 winners. Who knows if they had the likes of Tommy Bunhamel in defence, a fit, fresh, you know, a couple more, Len Graham could have been playing. I mean, there were players who were maybe not as good as those that got Northern Ireland to the quarterfinals. But instead of some of the walking wounded, if you had played a couple of the fresh players, could it have been different? We'll never know.
But there
has to be question.
Yeah, I mean, they also played a really crack French side with, you know, you mentioned Just Fontaine, who's got this kind of extraordinary goal scoring record at World Cups. Anyway, I mean, he was a brilliant player, but like, it's a great French side too. So you've basically played five matches now against fantastic teams. It's going to take its toll. And when you've got to play three games in, you know, such a short space of time, you know, to then meet France and then obviously it seems to have just caught up. So it's a difficult one to take. Could a 100% fit Northern Ireland take on France? Possibly, quite possibly. But it's still a great French side too.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it was three games in 4 days against the world champions, against the top Czechoslovakian side, and then against the top French side. So there were a lot of injuries. Harry Gregg did come back, but it was just too much. It was probably not much else we can say. And as I said, I think the key thing was the three teams that came through the playoffs 2 days later, all lost in the quarterfinals, and none of them scored a goal. I mean, the Soviets went out 2-0 to the Swedes, and Wales, they made their quarterfinal exit as well. They certainly made a game of it in Gothenburg. They held out until 24 minutes from the end, and a certain gentleman scored his first ever goal in a World Cup by the name of Pelé.
what a player he turned out to be. An extraordinary career all over the place, part of one of the greatest sides to ever win a World Cup as well, later on in 1970 as well. Extraordinary team. When we look back on this, we said at the start that it turned out to be, you know, one of the greatest kind of episodes in Northern Ireland kind of footballing history. How do we reflect on this period for Northern Ireland? Because it seems to just kind of, I won't say come out of nowhere, but they're building to something, and all of a sudden everything just seems to click, and it works, and they're playing brilliantly, they're scoring goals, etc., etc. So in terms of this World Cup and getting to the World Cup in the first place, how do we judge this for Northern Ireland?
Well, I mean, it has to be a golden era. And I mean, even if I run through some of the names, I mean, they remain legends. I mean, Harry Gregg, obviously, what more can I say about Harry Gregg? Alf McMichael of Newcastle United, incredibly talented fullback. Dick Keith, Danny Blanchflower, possibly Tottenham's greatest ever player. Yeah. The captain of their legendary double side in 1961. Who do you want? Billy Bingham, the winger who's scored some crucial goals. What a talented footballer he was. Obviously went on to be a fantastic manager as well. Peter McParland and those five goals, an Aston Villa legend. I'm probably forgetting some people as well. Billy Simpson, the Linfield and Rangers legend. What a talented player. If he'd been fit, who knows what could have happened. Billy went to the World Cup but never kicked a ball in it. So, and I mean, I'm forgetting players as well in that. Wilbur Cush, of course, who we'd already talked about, of Glenavon and Leeds United. The great Bertie Peacock of Celtic. Another Coleraine legend as well. I mean, he was a key player. Jimmy McElroy of Burnley. I mean, who else am I forgetting in that squad? I'm not doing it justice. So there's so many key players, legendary players. So it was very much a golden era for Northern Ireland, that so many good players, key top players came together at the same time. And I think you have to, we started off talking about Peter Doherty. You have to mention Peter Doherty's management as well. To bring all that together, you have a group of players that will run through a brick wall for him. They would have growing up idolizing the likes of Peter Doherty. Suddenly they get a chance to play for him. They play for him in a World Cup. and certainly they excelled, they overachieved.
It's that we kind of talked about it with the Republic of Ireland style. It's a generational thing, though, isn't it? I mean, when you grow up and you can watch the videos, you can watch all the matches and you can do all that kind of stuff, it kind of gets ingrained in you a little bit more, like Euro 88 and so on. Whereas, you know, we don't have the huge amount of kind of footage and coverage that there would have been for a 1958 World Cup. So perhaps it gets maybe lost a little bit because you can't do, you know, social media posts on it, and you can't, you know, do all that kind of stuff about it that you can do now with, you know, the likes of Northern Ireland in various other World Cups afterwards.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, first of all, the people at home would have been listening on the radio. They wouldn't have been watching it live on TV. They would have had the opportunity to go and maybe watch it on Pathé News and cinemas later. There were only a handful of fans. I've read the story about one fan who went, who went by motorcycle. And to go from motorcycle to Northern Ireland to Sweden is quite a journey.
Legend. And I'd love to get that story, knows it.
Yeah, the stories have been recorded, and there is actually a movie made on the, you can check it out by Clackety Films on the 1958. So there is a movie you can watch on it, but it's different times, and the World Cup, it's really in 1966. And I mean, RTÉ to their shame did not show a lot of that World Cup. But it's really to 1966 that the World Cup started to reach much bigger audiences with the advent of live television. In 1970 in Mexico, it was suddenly in Technicolor. It was in color. And obviously, it's grown astronomically since then. So if you talk about the likes of 1982, the likes of 1986, there were certainly thousands of fans could travel from Northern Ireland to Spain, maybe a bit less to Mexico, given the journey in those days. But certainly there were lots of Northern Ireland fans went to Spain in 1982. I still know some of them. And it was very different in 1958. It didn't have the same reach. You didn't have the media exposure, the TV exposure. And even the difference of the World Cup today to what it was in the 1980s is quite phenomenal as well. I mean, now the World Cup is probably the biggest. It's bigger than the Olympics. It's the biggest sporting event on the planet. It's watched by billions of people. And obviously qualification hasn't even started yet. Northern Ireland have probably secured a playoff, so they may still be involved. That is assuming they don't beat Germany and top the group. And I'm sure there's people listening to this saying, we're going to beat the Germans. But anyway,
where's your belief, Gary?
Yeah, you can go back to 1958. But if they don't manage to beat Germany and top the group, there is the fallback most likely of a playoff because of the winning their Nations League group. So they've certainly got a great chance of going to the World Cup next year. Obviously, from a Republic of Ireland perspective, we're looking ahead to a group with Hungary, Portugal and Armenia, and fingers crossed. But qualifying for the World Cup today just means such a bigger exposure, the amount of money involved. It's just phenomenal. It's just such a bigger tournament. And you certainly won't have games being played out in front of 6,000 people. Northern Ireland, at the time, became the smallest nation to ever play in a World Cup. What is it, population of 1.5 million. And up until, they held that record up until 2006, and Trinidad and Tobago took it from them. But they remain the smallest nation to ever play in a knockout game in a World Cup. And I think even that achievement in itself, and you can see the might and the size of some of the countries they were up against, is quite an achievement.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I want to give one final last mention to Peter McParland, who found himself on the goal-scoring charts with 5 goals, along with Vava of Brazil. But then just ahead of him are Helmut Rahn, Pelé and Jus Fontaine. So, I mean, pretty good company to keep in the goal-scoring charts at a World Cup.
Incredible for a man from Newry to do that. And I mean, I know he's an Aston Villa legend as well, but to score 5 goals and to score them against that quality of opposition, to score against Argentina, to score two against the Germans, two against the Czechs. What an incredible achievement. Just Fontaine's 13 goals in a World Cup has never been equaled. Uwe Seeler talked about him. I mean, he was the first man to score twice in four World Cups. I think he beat Pelé to that by a few minutes or something like that. And actually, I think he's the only man to have scored twice. He beat Pelé to being the first person to score in four World Cups. Legendary German striker, legendary Hamburg striker, and also one game for Cork Celtic, but maybe that's another story.
Well, I'm intrigued now. That's a story for another day. But absolutely fantastic. What a great story, and what a great achievement for Northern Ireland to find themselves in and play so well at the very first World Cup as well. Absolutely fantastic stuff. Gary, always a pleasure. Amazing stories as ever. Some great insights into an extraordinary period, an extraordinary moment in Northern Ireland football as well. So thanks again for that.
Yes.
Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops, plus some bonus clips as well. And of course, don't forget to subscribe. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League side. It's our heritage, it's our game. Bye for now.